Yeah, welcome to a new episode of the Case Podcast, so to speak, Case Reloaded. As you might have noticed, the last episode we had with Aino Corey is about 1.5 years ago, which kind of fall in the same time when our founder of the Case Podcast, Stefan Tilkoff, passed away. Sadly passed away, and ever since we didn't do any recording. But today is the first episode, and we off, let's say, the first episode with new hosts. So I'm Sven, I'm still with Case, but we also have two new hosts, Heinrich and Alex. And our idea of the podcast is kind of the same. It was all the time with conversations about software engineering. We just want to discuss technical topics without any limitation, whatever comes to our mind. And we want to use this episode to say hello, to say who we are, what our interests are, what you can expect from the podcast. We have a few new formats, new ideas, and also want to talk a little bit about things which are on our mind technically. All right, so who are we? First one is here on our list, Alex Heusingfeld. Alex, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. And thanks for the invitation to join the show. A little introduction about myself. I'm deeply involved in software architecture since, I would say, more than 10 years. So software engineering, a little bit longer history since the 1990s. And I'm currently responsible for technology strategy at Vorwerk.
So for all the international listeners, Vorwerk is quite a well-known brand in Germany, but what is Vorwerk actually doing for all the people who don't know Vorwerk?
Vorwerk is best known for producing vacuum cleaners for horses. No, seriously, that was in the 1920s. So I think in the meantime, Vorwerk will best be known for the Thermomix smart kitchen appliance and the recipe portal behind that, the Cookidoo platform. In the meantime, has, I think, about 18 million registered users and over 5 million paying subscribers. And in addition, Vorwerk also produces several vacuum cleaners and vacuum robots, for which there is also software and firmware to be produced.
All right. I know that stuff. Heinrich, who are you?
Hello, Sven. I'm Heinrich. I'm really thrilled to be joining you two on this amazing podcast. I'm a senior principal engineer at Zalando. And my kind of journey has for a long time on the path of building reliable systems and really understanding how to build software properly. I have a background in mathematics. I spent over 10 years in academia, like also having a PhD in the field. And ever since switching over, I had this feeling, there's a lot to be understood with just keeping things up, managing configuration properly, getting on top of logs and so on. And I got involved with one of the first metrics startups in the SaaS or metric SaaS companies, relatively small US-based company called Syconos, where I joined as a chief data scientist, basically looking at an analytical portfolio, developing query languages and understanding how to run anomaly detection on top of metrics data and so on. And then a few years later, I joined Zalando and also led their reliability organization, site reliability organization, for 2.5 years before now being back on the IC track. And so, as you can probably imagine, my focus and main interest remains in the SRE and reliability space. I think there are still a lot of interesting ideas which we or challenges that we have not yet tackled. And specifically, I see data as an emerging field in reliability engineering, like especially relevant. And there's a lot of new challenges and new interest since AI system are making a lot of use of data, and data management is becoming more and more important. And also reliability practices when it comes to like understanding incidents and observability in the data field are difficult. And I would really love to use this kind of forum to have discussions around those topics and improve my own understanding in the area and kind of take you all along with on the ride.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think, usually podcasts are a very good idea to do that. So I'm Sven. I'm with Case from the beginning. Previously, before joining Case or before co-founding Case, let's say, I was also a podcast host with IEEE Software Engineering Radio. And for me, you know, I used podcasts always for personal consulting. Yeah, it's always wonderful to talk to the best people in the world on a certain topic. Yeah,
yeah.
Which is good for me because I'm a consultant. Usually, you know, I'm pretty. There is a lot of stuff I'm solid in terms of software architecture, certain software engineering topics, software delivery. Also, maybe reliability engineering, I would also say, but not like Heinrich. But still, you know, that it's always great to, you know, if you want to dive deep on a topic, to just pick the person who is the best or one of the best in the world to discuss your interest. And I think also, my interest is usually also the interest of many, many other people. That's the idea.
So that means the format will change slightly. On the one hand, we'll have discussions among us. And in addition, we'll invite guests to the podcasts as it had been, right?
Exactly. So the interview with guests, that's I think that's proven and it's always fun and I really love it ever since, and it's a great way. But also we thought it would be nice, or actually I start anew. Alex and me, we once had a conversation, and then one of our colleagues, or I'd say former colleague of mine, he was like, yeah, it would have been nice to listen in. And then we said, okay,
yeah,
you know, we can do that. Yeah. And that is also, yeah, a second format where we just meet and discuss what's on our mind, latest news, some trends, whatever pops up, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, sorry to jump in here. This is really the essence of what I think good podcasting is. It's really informal. It's really to be like inviting people in to hopefully a somewhat private space, personal space, but certainly into interesting conversations between peers. And for me, it's like a big win if you can follow along without really focusing your full attention, but if you are on a walk or on the treadmill or something, you are just like able to dig in and listen on the side.
Yeah, that's true. It should be easy listening.
Exactly. Like, I mean, that's in the end what conversations are about, right? A little bit more relaxed, not that, maybe, okay, maybe still some information density, but not like information overload.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And hopefully we get along well. We will see.
Yeah, if not, we just split and we do just guests. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Maybe
what topics do we have today? What did you bring?
Maybe one thing before we jump to our topics. We also want to have two new publication channels. So what we haven't done yet was Spotify. So that should happen, maybe not directly, but soon. And also YouTube is big on our list, to have YouTube videos. I mean, not, I don't want to do too many promises or something like that, but there are lots of ideas around YouTube snippets, YouTube shorts and stuff like that. But yeah, let's see how that goes. I'm confident it will work.
I especially like the feedback possibility that you can get on YouTube videos, right? When people can comment specific scenes, specific sections on the video.
Exactly.
It's pretty interesting. Exactly. Because on the one hand, yes, of course, the information that you share to me is valuable to me, so our conversation. But in the end, I'm also very much interested what people out there think about and maybe can provide us additional perspectives. Because in the end, like, we're sharing the information to learn, right?
Exactly, exactly. Also, you know, what people want to discuss even deeper. Yeah. So for example, Heinrich and me, we recorded a podcast a couple of weeks ago. We published it. It's in German. Yeah. But I immediately got some feedback. Oh, you know, you didn't ask this. It was like, yeah, you know, we have only 1 hour time. But it's, you know, it's, I think it's also good to see what people still miss and want to dive deeper. And maybe one more thing, what you said is, if we have certain sections, you know, a podcast is usually one thing. It's a 1 hour thing or 1.5 hour thing. And of course you can have chapter marks.
Exactly.
But on YouTube, you can also have chapter marks, but you can also cut those chapters out and publish them independently. And I think it's worth a try. I follow some non-technical podcasts which do that. Mm-hmm. And I find it quite interesting to do it. On the other side, someone has to do it. So let's see. All right. Today we brought a few topics. Let's see how far we can get. Heinrich, you wanted to talk about cost of observability.
Yeah, I thought about this a little bit over the past weeks, and I just thought I'd bring it here as well. So I think a good starting point for this discussion is 2023, when Coinbase somehow leaked their Datadog bill, which was 65 million euros, which is a good bill. And it was at the beginning not clear if this was for a quarter or for the entire year. It was for the entire year. But I immediately started doing some math, just looking. I think they have 3 billion euros in revenue back in the day. So what could be their AWS bill or like their infrastructure bill, and what part of the 60 million there? I'm not really sure, but I know that you can get a lot of compute for 100 million euros in AWS. And Coinbase, I don't know why they would spend like tons and tons of money. They are not recoding videos. So I think it's in the ballpark of their infrastructure bill, maybe even larger than their infrastructure bill. I mean, this is pure speculation, of course, right? But this is kind of the information that came to the public. And that raises the question, is that too much, right? And the answer is, of course, yes, it's too much. They didn't want to pay it, and they realized, okay, they really have to do something. And they started experimenting, prototyping on-prem stuff. I think they had a Prometheus-based solution, I'm sure some nice time series backend behind it, and then started the porting effort. And then they went back to Datadog and said, they discussed and they arrived at a new deal, which is undisclosed, but I'm thinking it's a lot less. And yeah, it's an interesting story.
Yeah, but when you it wasn't the first bill they got, or was it really the first bill?
No, I think they were in this startup wonderland, right? They were just growing so fast that nobody cared about probably any kind of cost. I mean, again, I'm just widely speculating, but that is my guess. They're just growing fast, and this goes under the radar for a long time. But I'm sure the cost of that bill was getting a lot higher, faster, And then suddenly, if it's tens of million, it's just top level attention.
Yeah, I mean, usually you focus on what brings value to the product, because that's what investors want to know. But at a certain point in time, you have to look at the cost structure again, right?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. So, I mean, there is an interesting question, like how much value do you get out of observability? How much should you pay for it? Are the costs growing? Sometimes you have this cost creep that you kind of start with something which was relatively compatible, but then you're relatively affordable, but then you have volume-based pricing which kicks in. You have usually a relatively good amount of vendor lock-in. So even if the unit prices increase, you don't really have a great way to defend against this. So it's a tricky, sometimes a tricky place to be in, but, more generally, I think, like, how do you look at such a bill and how much are you willing to spend? And, I mean, back in the day, I think the idea was monitoring should be essentially free or not much of a premium on top of your costs. And I think we all now understand that this is not really realistic. It should be, you have to pay extra in order to get good observability. And but the first thing I just want to float, if it resonates with you, is I really think of this as a tax. So you basically have your stock infrastructure and your applications you're running. And then if I'm looking at a bill, I'm kind of always comparing it. So how much am I spending for my infrastructure? And how much additionally am I spending to have an observable kind of application or infrastructure on top of it?
I think the question that you have to ask is, what do you want to observe? So which questions do you want to have answered? I remember a time when developers built an application and they simply piped out everything that the application framework would send to the log output. And they didn't actually care about what messages this framework would send out. And like 90-95% of the logs were never used.
Yeah.
And then again, I think that was early 2000s something, when people started to look more into metrics, so beyond pure system operations, I would say. So don't know whether you remember the wonderful old Nagios.
Sure.
Then it happened that people were also like, yeah, we collect everything. We don't know when whether we'll use it. And
I remember those times, yeah.
yeah, but if you have SaaS products that say, well, we can actually make sense of all the data, of course you pay extra for that. I mean, sense making is not something simple, right? So you have to assume that you pay extra. So in the end, the question is, what insights do you want to create? What is relevant for the product that you're building? And then you need to look at what data do I need in order to gain that insight. And to me, in this case, observability is not different to, let's say, a customer-facing product that I'm building. Also for this, I need to understand what data do I need, no matter whether I present that data to the customer or I do something with the data, like, I don't know, insert it into a vector database so that an LLM can make use of it.
Yeah.
So you said it was the Datadog bill. Maybe a few steps back for my understanding. What is Datadog billing for, or what are the usual criteria for billing? I guess it's volume. I mean, yeah. Some have, like Dynatrace, they have custom metrics, right? They also bill for custom metrics. Datadog also bills for custom metrics. I forgot, but those are the two things.
Yeah, I mean, this brings a really good point here about the pricing models. I'm pretty sure the dominant factors are really volume-based pricing at Datadog. Mm-hmm. Some vendors have seat-based pricing, but maybe there are some components to the pricing that are seat-based or service number of services monitored. Yeah. But usually it kind of correlates strongly with volume. And it's, well, I think something to understand also from the cost structure side of a telemetry vendor, the infrastructure costs shouldn't be a large fraction of their whole like cost structure, right? It's usually dominated by the payroll, by the engineers that are working there. So it's like you are paying for having like superior like product development and good support and high reliability. You are not actually paying for the servers so much as a thing. And then there are like exercises you can do and really shrinking your volume. So you can get a lot, get very similar value by cutting your metrics, pruning your metrics very aggressively, not actually monitoring all the things, but just monitoring the things you really know that are valuable. Or you can be very aggressive with sampling and very smart. So you can manipulate your volume while actually maintaining a similar level of observability or value you are getting out of it. And I always feel like when I'm collaborating with a vendor, we shouldn't play that game of how little like metrics can I send, so I will kind of like expose your pricing system. And you as a vendor mm-hmm. shouldn't be playing the game of how much additional metrics can I sneak under by just making my agent more noisy so I can charge you more. So I always, yeah. I think the best conversations I really had of what is the value that this tool is providing me kind of uniquely versus kind of what does it cost, right?
Maybe I just want to throw in one thing because obviously Zalando is, I don't know, the top five largest retailer in Europe or something. So I just want to say lots of traffic, right? So
yeah,
there is, one second. and Alex, Vorwerk, you know, you mentioned the Thermomix, millions of people, you know, volume matters. Mm-hmm. But I also work for, let's say, finance companies, and mm-hmm. volume doesn't matter for them. So it's just, you know, if you have like a handful of users, I mean, it's maybe 1,000 users or 10,000 users, it's different from million users. For example, we, at my current customer, it's not that we don't care about the bill. I mean, I always, you know, look, oh, how much does this extra metric, custom metric costs? But it's, you know, it's not that bad. I think we have to distinguish, right, between high traffic websites and low traffic websites.
Well, in the end, it's always a decision on cost per user. So what cost per user do you want to accept? What is sustainable for the service that you're offering? So on the one hand is the value perspective in terms of what does observability bring to the product, to the value. And on the other hand is what is the cost of a user that is using the service?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I want to say something as a disclaimer. I don't want to raise the impression that I'm like talking about exclusively Zalando here. That is Zalando here. It's like the thing is, it's a general topic, and of course I have some bias experience, but I'm really reflecting like the learnings that are larger and are in the industry. And to get to this point, actually the user is a really interesting bit here, because who is actually the user? So there is there's the internal user, of course, right? That is using the service. And actually, there is a lot of value that is provided to the user that is not just looking at telemetry, but it's also consuming the telemetry, having documentation around this, and a good user experience. So that is a value that has to be captured somehow. And then there is the end user of the business that is actually like your revenue source. And you also provide value to them in terms of reliability, right? So sometimes you can even quantify that, but it's hard to say how much better did the reliability go because I have just a great observability provider, right?
The challenge here to me is twofold. On the one hand, It's definitely the quality of the observability tooling in terms of what insights can it show you. On the other hand, it's also a skill set that you need to transform the value that the observability brings to you into customer value. So the skill set of the development team call it DevOps team, right? The person that makes sense of the observability data and takes decisions based on that in order to turn it into the customer value. And I was recently discussing with a colleague on the topic of OpenTelemetry, and he said, well, actually, we don't need any additional data. We can create most of the observability data from the spans that we collect. So you only need to send the spans, and that's all. And that was pretty interesting. As I said, 20 years ago, no, seriously, actually not so long ago, we were taking the system metrics, right? CPU usage, memory usage. And the question to me was, has that really become irrelevant? I don't think so. So it doesn't help me to understand whether there is a problem. I agree. Right? That's just an indicator that helps you detect the root cause of a problem.
I really love that last statement, also what your colleagues reflected, because I think OpenTelemetry, it's a really great technology, and hearing that people are already basically exclusively banking on tracing, that is, I think, that's a great starting point. It's a much better starting point than, okay, I have tons of logs, and help Absolutely. Me understand from this mess kind of what did my users feel. And I think that what is fundamentally correct about it is the anchor point. The anchor point has always to be user experience, and the spans are the thing that gets closest to it. Yeah. So the better I can understand this and then reason about, okay, what was degraded, what caused it, which is essentially the trace, just following the trace along, that is just a great start. And that's something you cannot automatically kind of aggregate up from just expensive logs or a lot of signals that your servers are emitting. That's something that you have to put in as a developer that is kind of following along the business logic and making sure kind of your trace context is propagated. Yeah. So I think that's a great starting point. It's not the end of the road. I mean, I already talked about data where it's a lot more complicated, but I still think the resource metrics are quite important, and the pod health metrics in the Kubernetes environment are more important. What happened is that a lot of the scheduling concern has been taken out of the developer things they have to care about, right? So they don't have to do this exercise every year where they will tell you how big of a box this application needs to run in so I can kind of survive the sales peak. So there you need 3 years of history of CPU utilizations on all your servers in order to understand how do you provision this box. Yeah. And now it's much more, okay, your infrastructure team needs to know, think about the cost and how large a Kubernetes cluster may get if that is a problem for the backplane at some point. But it's a very different game, and therefore I think the relevance of resource metrics has somewhat diminished.
Agree. In the end, I would say observability tooling is another tool in the tool chain of developers, and they need to understand how to use it.
Yeah. And I think this brings us to the next topic.
Observability training. Yeah, so I give trainings, and usually it's software architecture fundamentals and improving software architecture, but I also, I have this little love on reliability engineering. And I used to give a very short observability training. Huh. It was only 2 hours for another consultancy, and I have this material. And now I have been asked for 2 days of observability training instead of 2 hours.
And you collected Grafana's screenshots, or what did you do?
No, I mean, I have all the topics. Yeah, I have a little outline what I want to discuss, but I just wanted to talk to you guys what you think is, you know, what are key takeaways. Let's start with the key takeaways. There are many questions, but key takeaways regarding an observability training. Maybe one context. The context is software architects. I mean, yeah, it's senior software engineers. There is a whole training program. And why are you laughing?
You're triggering me and you know that.
Anyway, so the target group the target group is software engineers, software architects. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of embedded in a larger program. So what are the general key takeaways?
So far is that I'm also a chairman of the executive board of the International Software Architecture Qualification Board. And in our advanced level exams, I regularly see people neglecting the operational effect or whether an application they design can actually run or it's sustainable, it's economically sustainable that the design will actually work in production and not run the company bankrupt. And that's something that I see very often neglected. And on the other hand, I always thought, like, we train people from the beginning, hey, start with the requirements and not only the functional requirements, but also make assumptions on non-functional requirements, or what we call them is quality goals and quality scenarios. And these quality scenarios, in the end, are expectations that you can design in your observability system. So you can use that scenario and validate this, because in the end, the scenarios are hypotheses how the system shall behave in production.
Yeah. I do have a little workshop where I talk to major stakeholders. You know, I help architects and product owners and stuff like that to understand their operational requirements. Yeah. Because, you know, you might write, I'm just, you know, something stupid here. Yeah. You might write, I want 99.9% availability. I mean, people write that down without understanding what it actually means. You know, how much downtime is it? Is it for the whole service? Is it for major use cases? Whatever, you know, it's, they don't know. So what I try to do, there is to explain everyone, you know, focus on major use cases first. You know, we are not looking at the availability of, you know, every request on every endpoint. Yeah. So what are the major use cases? So that would be step number one. Then step number two, understand what do I need? And I don't talk about nines. I don't know what you think, but I think talking about nines is good for, it's maybe good for dashboards, but usually I talk minutes or hours of downtime.
I wouldn't even talk about that, but actually about expectations in terms of some stakeholder or maybe multiple stakeholders want to have that use case. What is their expectation? When do they say, yes, this use case works in production? So for example, some stakeholders said, yes, if the payment flow takes 3 minutes, then it takes 3 minutes. That's perfectly fine. And exactly. Some say, well, if that request doesn't finish within 10 seconds, then it's a problem. So expectations.
Yeah, and I think it's also not that you have to kind of set those expectations in stone from the very beginning, right? But to have a process to capture them and then to revisit them and kind of evolve the design as we understand the requirements better and the actual requirements and the cost of incidents, I think that's a good way to look at it. But overall, I really agree with this high-level take of understanding what the service should be doing and how good it should be performed. And usually that also is overlapping with your SLO portfolio you might want to have for that service. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to do the full implementation and have it measured and so on, but those would be the things that you later put SLOs on.
Yeah. Actually, I once did a webinar with Yuri Olenik. So Yuri used to be the product manager for Instana's service level objective, I don't know, initiative maybe. And that was the idea that Instana, for example, they actually had a nice implementation, I think, of service level objectives. At least at that time, I don't know how it's now. but the big question was, of course, also for them, how do I come to those objectives? I mean, and that's basically what we now here discussed, right? So, and that's also what I discussed in the webinar. Start with the stakeholders and try to understand what they need.
That's exactly the point.
Yeah, there's a big difference between getting the number of nines right and just understanding what this SLO should be in the sense of what should it measure, what is the functionality that it should cover.
Yeah.
And this is the starting point. And for every application, you probably have like maybe one, maybe five things that it should do, which is basically the core job of the product manager to tell you what you expect it to do. So that is like a great starting point that you can like arrive with the manager and the product manager. Like, this is the thing it should do. And then you can go to your engineers and say, hey, we need observability if it's actually doing the things that it's doing. And ask a technical question, how would I know that it does it, right?
The interesting part for me is that you have to wrap your head around what you aim to build. Because some things are not so obvious. So if we're talking service level objectives, how do you measure replaceability of a service? So if the goal is that you can replace a service within 30 minutes, how do you measure that? Right? If you say, I want to be able to release a new version within 30 minutes, right? I replace the previous version with a new version. So bug fix releases, for example. It's not something that you measure on your production environment, actually. It's something that you measure, for example, in the pipeline or in the code repository, wherever you have the data, or actually you need to accumulate some data. So the question is really, what are you building for? What are the quality scenarios that your stakeholders expect from you? So what is reliability in the end?
But now, I mean, I would exclude actually that one. You know, when I understand you correctly, you want for you it's a quality scenario. How fast can I? How? What's the lead time between
mean time to repair?
Oh, that's what you mean. Okay, so you mean there is a big problem in production. There is a failure. How fast can I get the fix out?
What is failure? Failure could also be, darn, I thought this feature was great, but it isn't. Let's replace it again.
Yes. As soon as you have developer time in it, then you invite a huge variable. I think this kind of the time the CI system takes to build it and to deploy it and hopefully also test it, I think that's a very, very concrete thing we can measure and like monitor over time. Like probably you don't even need to do this with operational monitoring. You can just like report it after every build, and then you know if it's a problem that you should address, right?
At the same time, if we're talking let's replace the feature, it could be a fix forward, so replace the feature with something else. It could also be like let's replace it with the previous version.
Yeah.
And then the question of reliable builds comes in. So do I still have the binaries of the previous version? Do I need to rebuild it? Have I reserved all the third party libraries that I need to build it? So all of that stuff. And that gets even more interesting if we're not talking server side applications, but client side applications like firmware updates.
That's true. So much pain, I don't even want to go there.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's all topics that architects need to understand. What am I building for?
So I would really distinguish here a little bit between the application architects and maybe like platform engineering and engineering that happens on the platform below, because like lead time or time to deploy, that's clearly a KPI that a platform team would track. For every application that is released on that, it should be able to tell you this. And ideally, if it's a standardized runtime or thing you are deploying to, have that kind of in mind. I haven't really seen this as a like an operational signal that is kind of actively managed the way that you monitor a microservice or you monitor an error rate. Because also the cycles, I mean, sometimes you only have maybe one or two or zero deployments a week. So it kind of pans out on a different time scale. And I mean, the requirement is pretty easy to make, right? You want to be able to roll back a change within 10 minutes. But I haven't seen that monitored or tested, that like everybody is kind of every hour rolling something back or forward to kind of ensure that this is continuously the case. I mean, maybe there's some scenario where you do it, but
we're even getting into a different space now. That's the topic of business continuity management and disaster recovery. It's actually the same, right? If the system crashes completely, and how fast can you rebuild it? How fast can you get the service back up? How fast can you get the platform back up?
Yeah,
that's something. Yeah. Like it's the same with deployments, right? If you deploy very often, you're used to that. You likely automated 90% of that, so the chance of human error is very, very low. But if you don't regularly test the restore of a database, for example, you might not even have wrapped your head around how to test for data integrity.
But is this a topic for an observability training?
Depends.
I mean,
in the end, you can verify all that with observability tooling today.
I mean,
actually, you can put all of that into Nagios.
Yeah, I mean, maybe one hint. Yeah. So the observability training, as I said, it's embedded in a larger program. Mm-hmm. And also reliability engineering is another 2-day training. Yeah. So we can distinguish. There is even the question, should we even discuss SLOs in the training, because there is an SRE training.
So
but it belongs together.
I mean, I think the anchor points are very interesting. We already talked about
One second. It belongs together. Yes, that's true. Not my decision, but you know, that's the case. Yeah, maybe we change that in the future, but right now that's the setting. Mm-hmm. And there is the SRE part and there is the observability part.
That would raise a question towards how that company is organized. If they separate it, that's usually a reason of organization, but I guess that Heinrich wanted to say something else.
No, just to answer that question, it's a very large company, and the answer on this is usually we have everything. You know, every setup which exists, we have it. Every tool which exists, we have it. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay.
I mean, what I would like to say is that the anchor points matter. And I think you have to understand that you're trying to observe the user experience. That is the ultimate goal. Yeah. And there, the SLOs are kind of a natural like relation that you have, because they are also fundamentally anchored in user experience. And from there, it kind of trickles down. of course, what the machines are doing is also important, that you may be able to even kind of detect latencies that you have when you are talking to certain hardware components. So it kind of goes down the stack. But I think like starting there and having this as a goal, that I need to understand the behavior as it relates to the user or like upstream dependencies or people that call you, that is like a good starting point. Then the question is like, how do you actually get there and how do you allow operators to reason about this state? And I think knowing about the different telemetry types, how they are relating to each other is pretty crucial. It should be mentioned that traces are usually the gold standard when it comes to transactional microservices integrated over REST, right? REST APIs that talk to each other. There's nothing better than tracing. And how to do that with OpenTelemetry in different language stacks that I would expect every kind of engineer to understand. Depending how practical you want to go, you can do that as hands-on exercises or leave it at here are some things, libraries you might want to check out. You need to understand how to complement this with other telemetry types like logs and metrics. And there's an interesting twist here that I do want to elaborate a little bit on when it comes to events versus logs versus traces and observability 2.0. In my view, there is quite a bit of confusion, but there's also some meat here that's, I think, worth highlighting. So in the end, I would distinguish kind of between event monitoring and kind of resource monitoring. Resource monitoring is like the temperature of a room. That is something, it's a relatively small aspect of monitoring, but that is something where metrics are clearly excellent. And then everything else, it's basically events that happen, like a request being served, a scheduling event that took place and did something. And so how do you actually best represent an event? Well, like an object, a structured object or a log line is actually fairly lateral, right? Something happens, here's some information about what happened. Now the question becomes basically, how do you store it? How do you process this? How do you index it? What do you store and all kinds of this stuff? And a lot of the complexity of around metrics is really about how this aggregation happens. If you're rolling it up in different time intervals, if you're taking averages, if you're taking percentiles, taking histograms. So it's a lot about event aggregation. And spans and traces are actually just events. That's also very important to understand. There's nothing in principle from the data structure that is like distinguishing a structured log from a span. The only special thing is a span always has a trace ID and a parent ID. So it basically carries two IDs, and it's usually stored in a system that is heavily optimized for certain joins you're able to make. So kind of tracing is a very opinionated subset of event processing system. And logs is also a opinionated event processing system, which is just very unopinionated, if you like. It just take everything and index everything or nothing. So it's like a completely different take on the same thing.
Let me
finish this arc. There's insight around observability 2.0 in the events versus logs. And there's a lot of language that is pushed that I'm not really on board with, but I think there's also a lot of, like, there's some merit here and some very good things. First insight is that just events is a fairly general concept that can be materialized as logs, but it happens very much on the way, what actually, how you are storing it, how you're indexing it, and so on. And there is insight in having fat, wide events. I was actually advocating against this for a long time. So the basic question is, if you have a function with a chunk of business logic in it, when do you log? So you may have multiple steps across the function where meaningful work happens. Do you kind of log at the start, at the middle? You get correlation problems because you have to afterwards kind of piece it together. If you have 50 threads parallel in a system, you just created a mess. It's pretty noisy. And the alternative way to do it is kind of the fat event style, where you are kind of keeping track of the function, the states in memory, and at the very end, just write out a single big event. And that is kind of the what people call event-based monitoring. It's basically the idea of not having micro logs, but having these large blobs of logs, and then having some more indexing in your storage solution, so you're able to do certain joins well.
Yeah,
and so, that is kind of my high level take.
Okay, I do have a few questions on that one.
Okay,
so maybe one remark. I would say my original idea, it's not my idea, is similar. So the what's the name of the guy who wrote the DEPA paper and created the DEPA?
Ben Siegelman,
exactly. Yeah. So he has a framework, you know, what he thinks is observability. And that framework, yeah. I just use that I use that for my past training. It's, so he says, is it broken? That's one question you want to answer. That is basically connecting the business to the software systems, right? That's what we discussed with understanding the user needs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Take the, is the user experience, does it has a problem? Then the other thing he discusses is what's broken. That's what, where I have a few questions in a second. And the other thing I also think is important is, you know, what types of metrics, what types of telemetry data exist? That's also what you guys said, right? So metrics, logs, traces, stuff like that. Infrastructure, how is that stuff stored? Or storage, maybe not infrastructure, storage. So now, when you talked about observability 2.0, you know, I remember Mipsy Tipsy talking about it. What's her real name?
Charity Mayers,
exactly. Yeah. But I kind of forgot, I must say, what the difference is between 1.0 and 2.0. That would be question number one. Question number two, your idea of the logs and then send another event. What tools can I actually use to have those queries? Yeah, to create those queries. I mean, I understand Honeycomb. Alex is looking like that. I mean, I don't know how to do that with. Currently, I use, for example, Dynatrace, and I just don't see how I can do that with Dynatrace. Whatever Charity Mayers says, right? And I just don't know. You know, is it even worth talking about? Because not all the tools support it, or is it something, you know, we should talk about as the future of observability? Am I now a bit? I hope it wasn't too confusing.
So the second question is relatively straightforward. So if you have a logging database that stores logs, structured logs, right? What kind of queries can you do against the logs, right? And then also, which kind of indexing do you have on it? There are. A lot of things people can do and a lot of different things that tools can in the market. I don't have like fully researched this, so I cannot say like this is exactly what are the capabilities. But if you look at Splunk and tools like Elasticsearch Kibana, then you have basically full text indexes on this. So you can ask this kind of questions. And there are also tools that index columns in that. So if you have specific attributes that are just picked out and then they're stored separately. For example, do with Loki, and then you have like a relatively fixed attribute set that you can query it with a SQL-like functionality. And yeah, I mean, Honeycomb
important because I mean I understand Honeycomb is let's say I can do those queries in Honeycomb, and I thought I need to have a tool like Honeycomb to do those queries. But what you say is, you know, just have a typical log solution.
I mean, it's basically group by ID or a filter by ID, and then you get all the events. Yeah. You can do that with a SQL database. Yeah, yeah, you can do it with grep on the command line if you really want. And there are tons of log solutions who can do parts. What I think Honeycomb is uniquely good at is the convenience around it, the visualizations you get on top of it, and kind of having insights and opinions on how it should all kind of fit together to this observability 2.0 that happened. And maybe I can just answer your first question now, which is, what's the difference? And I think a lot of it is just like one has to understand the history a little bit here. Observability has been around for a very long time as a term in the industry. I think 2007 or 8, my former boss already talked about observability, but it wasn't a really thing that everybody was talking about. And really, when Charity came with Honeycomb, which took the ideas from Scuba that were in Facebook and brought them to the main stage, they kind of pushed these new ideas under the term observability. And they proactively were advocating for embracing kind of events, generalized events, together with specific query patterns as a kind of one-stop-shop solution for all kinds of operational observability, where you don't need to put a lot of time into dashboards and tracing and whatnot, just because you use fed events in the sense like wide events and put them into it like a capable database. This solves a lot of problems. And that was the original meaning of the term observability. Now, what then happened was the observability term became popular and everybody jumped onto it. And and now it basically means logs, metrics, and tracing, right? That is basically what observability has come to mean. And nobody, everybody kind of forgot what the original idea was. And now kind of Honeycomb, I'm reading this into this, right? Is like, okay, we have kind of lost this term. So let's kind of reintroduce the term, giving the original meaning. but it needs a 2.0 now. I didn't really see any changes of the idea. And again, I think the level, like the delineation to structured logs, it's you have to read really exactly the fine print. It's more how you hold it than what it actually is. So I think, and I mean, I know a lot of people that are involved, and I have very high regards and good feelings for them. But for me, there is a lot of marketing in these things. It's really, I think the great idea is wide events, good indexing, nice visualizations. I'm sure Honeycomb does a lot of this very good. And this is where the meat is. And this is what can be learned. But you can do a lot of this with good structured log solutions. You can do a lot of this with good tracing solutions, which is basically for most stacks that I'm like involved with, it's based HTTP microservices. Then it all fits kind of into span and trace structures. So you don't actually need a lot of other events than that. Yeah.
I'm not sure that I'm fully with the fed events yet, but I remember the time when the term observability came up, and I remember especially Charity Mayers tried to explain the different mindset behind, saying, hey, let's observe the system. Let's not assume that we know everything up front, but actually provide a way to look at the system in production. So that was the difference from monitoring beforehand. And like 90% of the people in the room were like, ah, so observability is the new term for monitoring. Okay, we call it observability then. that's not exactly what she said. I'm not so sure that people will actually understand that. And now if we call it observability 2.0, that this is actually about making assumptions and let's call it, I know that I don't know and I know that I cannot predict production mindset.
Yeah, I think the interesting question is what enables this kind of explorative approach to debugging, right? What really allows you to understand on a meaningful level what your system is doing, like observe the system without a lot of like opinionated and thoughtful signal collection. And I think some of this is kind of monitor all the things, just have all metrics enabled or just be extremely verbose with logging. But that path really led nowhere. So it's just too expensive and you cannot really filter stuff out. And I think a very good insight here is that you can get away with a moderate amount of really wide events, which give you just enough context and enough attributes to join on, that it is enables this kind of like explorative analysis. But and then you can get away with a lot less metrics and a lot less dashboards and so on, right?
The topic here is that this is your conclusion. And I know that other companies said, well, obviously, software as a service observability tooling is not for us because the cost is way too high. So we move back on-prem, so we don't pay extra for all the logs and the metrics that we send. So they didn't actually wrap their head around the topic of what do I need? What is actually relevant? And that is what the takeaway that I get from your pledge for fat or wide events. The issue that I have with the wide events is how often have you seen a process die in the middle of operations? And
yeah, I mean, and this is exactly my objection. I was never a fan of it at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what happens if it crashes? Because I was also on a C stack by then. I had tons of sec faults, and these were the most interesting things. So I was always actually having arguments on Twitter, is it really the right thing? Mm-hmm. And also there was a production incident at Honeycomb, which they couldn't diagnose exactly because of this problem. So you leave a door open for problems which are becoming hard to diagnose. However, interestingly, we are like a lot of other companies are not using C stacks, right? They have Java stacks. They have error handling. They don't see this kind of stop the world behavior that much. And the other thing is in practice, it hasn't been that much of a problem. So I'm not claiming this is kind of the solution. I'm claiming it's an idea worth exploring that works in a lot of contexts, and it works better than just monitor all the things.
Okay. Maybe what I wanted to say didn't come across. The topic is, and I had the discussion like several months ago, when an SRE at Forvec told me, well, of course, we don't grab all the logs. Our log pipeline might miss a few logs if there is too much traffic on the channel, then we drop some logs. And I was still I was still raised with this, no, you must not lose any log events because then you cannot diagnose your system. And in the meantime, I'm like, well, what does a customer do if the payment flow fails? If the payment flow returns an error, what do they do? Well, they click on the button again. It's the same that I do with the light switch. If the light doesn't turn on, I click the button again.
Yeah.
So what?
Yeah, right. The question is the error reproducible, like, or is it consistent? You sometimes have stuff that happens in a single market or for a single Android version, then mm-hmm. the retry wouldn't help. So that's actually something that is very interesting to understand. Is it an admitted error or not? And I don't really know, I have not seen so much telemetry systems that are really good at telling those differences.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah.
What I was trying to say, if the issue happens more than one time, then your observability system will certainly catch it.
Oh yeah, so yeah.
There is no need to lock everything.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I had a P1 incident once when we were like, okay, what is actually happening? Yeah, there is an issue with Italy. The customers cannot cook, and then we found out. Yeah, well, it was 8 customers.
Yeah,
that has an issue because of one phone provider blocking our IP.
Yeah.
So 8 customers in the whole of Italy. It's like, yeah. Okay. And they connected their devices via their mobile phone. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with this take. I think losing a few log lines, there's no harm. And what you also see, people being very systematic with actually sampling their logs or their traces or their events, like very heavily, sometimes one to 10,000. So you are really not actually storing and processing all that much. And if you're smart about this, and there
I believe
some
DEPA,
companies,
right? DEPA started with this, right?
Yeah.
It's throwing away 999 out of 1,000 traces or something like that.
I mean, distributed tracing just looks completely insane. On on the premise of it, you're basically saying we replace every single HTTP request with yet another request. We add yet another on top, right? Because you need to get the span somehow out of the system. And you're creating all that metadata that is actually pretty close to the actual volume. And those systems get incredibly high loaded. And like initially, you didn't think you could get actually away without heavy sampling. Now it turns out that actually, if you are smart with engineering this, keeping everything in memory, be careful with kind of your attention boundaries, you can get away with a very, very modest sampling rates, which is just absolutely fascinating. And it's also something, like, I think it took so long to discover this. I mean, okay, there were really technical boundaries. The computer system weren't that capable for a long time. But I think there was a very good amount of just being bold enough to do something that sounds that kind of intractable. And I'm still like betting that in the data space, there's something possible, which is similarly crazy, which is just like everybody discards because it's just way, way too expensive and creates too much metadata. But it turns out actually just multiplying all the data we have by a factor of two is not that of a problem. It's not that expensive. And we can probably just do it and then be okay.
That's interesting. Like learning from the reliability space is might be interesting, or actually like looking at different spaces and saying, okay, what can I accept from it in terms of extract and adapt?
Yeah,
and that is going to be interesting. There's another topic that I'm currently wrapping my head around. That's as you know, I recently bought a house and I'm looking into core renovation, and I'm currently looking into what does smart home have to offer in 2024, and it's really like this range of opinions, right? People saying, well, we do everything with Zigbee because it's so flexible, and if you place the switch here or there, or tomorrow you place it in the kitchen, it's not a problem. And then you have like the hardcore electrical engineers like cable. that's pretty interesting. And at first I was like, okay, what patterns from software engineering can I actually adapt to my smart home? And in the meantime, I'm the other way around and thinking like, okay, what patterns from classical architecture and engineering or building should we actually adapt to software engineering, because their buildings last for decades?
I mean, we already adapt a lot of things, right? So views, for example, yeah, views on software, you have different views: structural view, runtime view, infrastructure view. It's the same with normal architecting. You have a view on the electrical stuff, on the materials, on how the the structure of the building. So we do already adapt a lot of things, I think, in software engineering from architecture. Yeah, cross-cutting concerns. On the building, you have windows and carpets and stuff like that. We have the same. Yeah, we have cross-cutting concerns in software.
Yeah,
like logging.
I was more thinking of there is a principle that I'm advocating for quite heavily in the recent months. That's built for replacement, because the technology landscape is shifting so rapidly that. Yeah. Sustainability of a system is actually not the technologies that we're using, but the functionality. And we continuously need to check whether there is new technology out there that can do the job better, faster, more sustainable, and whether we should actually replace that. And that's a topic in the end of modularization that, in my point of view, we see in some of the buildings out there.
There is an interesting book. It's called how buildings learn. You know, just buy it, put it on your living room
shelf.
Yeah, and then every visitor is like, "Ooh, how buildings learn." And it actually, it also talks about the change of the change rate in buildings, and I found that is quite interesting. You know, if
What are the things that you need to change quite frequently?
Exactly.
Just one example. Yeah. I had this discussion with an electrical engineer who was completely against using pipes for the cables. He said, "Well, we put the cables in the wall. What should happen to the cables?" And then there was another electrical engineer who said, "Well, I recently renovated the house of my parents from 1969." And I was actually very happy to have all the cables in the pipes because the cables were like... So I would say there is no black or white, right or wrong, but it's really context specific. And that's something that I'm really looking forward to wrap my head around in the next couple of weeks and months when I'm renovating the building.
Yeah, you could have a look into... Actually, you don't need to buy the book, How Buildings Learn, because you may remember... I mean, most systems are the big ball of mud, right? Mm-hmm. So the design pattern
is... Are you talking about buildings? Have you seen
software,
mine?
Software. No. I'm just talking about software. So software, it's the big ball of mud. And there is this from, I think, Joe Yoda. We put it in the show notes. There is this big ball of mud.
With an website. Affiliate link of yours?
Exactly. And they look at how buildings learn and translate it to software. And I think it's an interesting... Okay. I think it's interesting also for you, you know, to look at this page to see how real architects look at the rate of change on a building, because the house of the parents from 1969, certain things are still the same like 50 years ago, and other things they change weekly, maybe even or monthly. But there are also a lot of things in between. You know, there are certain layers of rate of change. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good framework to think about change. You know, when people talk about, you know, you have to do that, it's an interesting idea to think, okay, how long does this need to last? Yeah, usually. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, maybe we can also span it to organizations, because software systems rarely live on a green field, but usually have people around it. And that's also going to be interesting. Like, software can change very frequently, but what about the organization around it? How fast can people adapt to new technologies, for example?
And now
we have quite some stuff to cover.
Yeah.
But maybe not today.
That's true. I just wanted to say, first we shape the buildings and then the buildings shape us, but that doesn't fit into into the organization.
That's only for certain wall material, right? That they shape us.
Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, for me, it's still like this motivation, like coming from building sites is pretty important for me. I mean, I'm a mathematician from the background, right? And we really OCD about proper foundations. At the beginning of the 20th century, they have this books by Gottlob Frege and the Hilbert program and logic, where you have like thousands and thousands of pages with proving 1 + 1 = 2, right? And so like just proving it from better principles and really, really building solidly. And in software, I never felt this feeling of this is solid. And I think a big conceptual difference is that a lot of the software systems are much more like dynamical systems and not like just static system, which you kind of put in an equilibrium. You always kind of want to be responsive. You have a CPU that is doing something all the time. And so the way you actually get stuff to be like well-behaved and reliable is much more like by feedback loops, by things that are stabilizing things that have come out of order and kind of try to keep it in check, much less just gluing things in place and then it hoping that it will stand for a long time. And actually, there are some counterintuitive things that if you are gluing things too strong and you are basically trying to build too thorough, it becomes so stiff, it cannot adapt, and it's just too expensive or even unstable because it has some brittleness properties. Yeah. So it's, but I still think, hopefully, I mean, and a lot of this has actually already happened. We are able to build on stronger foundations. When I look at the build chains, for example, and our deployment tooling, right? So from copying PHP files to a FTP server, like in the early 2000s, late 90s, when you were deploying your first web apps, to now like deploying containers to Kubernetes with a CI/CD pipeline and version control and all of this. So I think we are at a better place, but I have still hopes for a much more rigorous and solid way to build without sacrificing too much speed.
Yeah, looking at buildings, I mean, building architects had thousands of years to evolve.
Yeah.
And I would agree. I mean, if we look back 20 years, it's, you know, the things got way better. I once had a call with an analyst and with a customer. And the analyst wanted to know how we, you know, do certain things. Industry analyst from Gartner, I believe. And I was complaining all the time. You know, this is crap. This is shit. This doesn't really work because there is so much stuff to improve. And then at some point he said, wait a second, you know, can you start talking about when you started 3 years ago? And then we were like, oh, 3 years ago. I mean, this was full disaster. I mean, we don't even talk about it. And then just to see what happened in those 3 years was mind-blowing for us even, right? So when the call was over, we all three said, we are so happy to see how far we got. Yeah. So even in an organization within 3 years. So I,
But I think this is beautiful. I like, there's a quote, I think from the Slack CEO, it's a few years back, where he was always like, I'm so embarrassed about my product. I see so many things that are just terrible. And I know so many things that I want to improve. And yet Slack was like light years ahead of Microsoft Messenger or IRC. It was like night and day. And he was like talking down on his product. And I mean, the upsides were obvious that he has so many like ideas and ways to improve further. You want to have some of this. I will not take a opinion on whether Slack has actually improved, but I think
technically probably
for sure. And I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm not just not a big Slack user, and I think there are that the opinions are differing. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
I would
just
say
looking at, I'm there, just looking
there, are,
at the time.
There are a lot of things that we can cover in the coming episodes.
Yeah. Homes and home automation and stuff like that.
Reliability engineering in other fields than software.
And it was fun.
It's going to be interesting. So, at least for me, this is the last working day this year. So I'm actually looking forward to close the year and do a reflection in terms of what you just said, right? Look back at the end of last year and what did we actually achieve? And if I had to fire myself, what would I want to provide as input to my successor on what to go after for the next year? And maybe let's see. I'm also looking at things that I can bring to the podcast.
Yeah, that I think it's a good, I have a topic for our first episode in the next year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how to...
So you're already teasing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting discussing how to, you know, how to look back and how to look forward.
Yeah.
That's, and actually how to look forward and also reflect on your way, because, you know, I can easily look back and easily look forward, but the execution of looking forward, doing what I'm looking forward, that's hard. Yeah. Anyway, I think that would be something I would bring to our new episode, to our first episode in the new year.
Looking forward to that. I can definitely learn, because I really have a hard time to, let's say, recognize successes, achievements, and that's why I really have to, like, stop myself from doing anything and really look at what the last couple of months, years brought, and looking forward to learn from the two of you how you do that.
Yeah, you can learn from failure from me. So that's
that's the best learnings, failures that I don't have to do.
Exactly.
There is so much. Love to explore that topic. I feel like the two cents I want to say now is closing down a day, year or day is something very powerful, where you have so many things that you may want to have done and they are nagging you, and being able to just shut the book and say, it was a good year, let's make peace with this and, like, start afresh. There's a lot in that. And then it's all in the mind. Reality doesn't really matter. The mind matters.
It's not only, the year, but also the week, the month.
Yeah, so, yeah, but exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's call it a day. And the episode will be published in 2025. So, you know, I can only wish you guys a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. The audience already has it behind. And yeah, we already teased our new topic for the next year. Also, yeah, exactly. Also, interviews are planned with external guests, right? So not that you think we don't do this anymore.
They'll keep you posted.
Yeah.
All right. So thanks and see you then. Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye.